Monster Man, special episode, Unique Monsters. Hello, and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm taking a look at the monsters that I find in them, their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Today's episode is a special episode brought to you by the generosity and public spirit of my Patreon backers, and in particular, of Patreon backer Luke. If you'd like to be like Luke and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and back at the $5 level. And if you do that, you'll get your own special episode as well as access to the rewards for other levels, including all new episodes of my other podcast, Patron Deities. So Luke, thank you very much for your support. And I hope that you enjoyed today's episode. Luke has asked me to talk about keeping unique monsters special. And I think that in order to look at this topic, we have to start by defining what we mean by unique monsters. Because I think that there are, roughly speaking, and of course they do overlap, but roughly speaking, three different ways of presenting unique monsters in your typical fantasy RPG. The first up is the simplest, and that is a world in which there just aren't types of monsters. So you will never meet an orc. This is something that you would find in like a Conan story, right? Almost, you know, Conan never fights an orc, maybe a demon, but even then the creatures within that category of demons seem to be quite distinct from each other. And this is sort of the sword and sorcery tradition. Monsters in that type of fantasy are a bit more like horror monsters, and I think it's not surprising that the role-playing games that I sort of associate with that idea tend to be a little bit more like horror games. So games like The Between or Monster of the Week, even if they do, I mean, I'm not saying they absolutely 100% all the time only have unique monsters, but that would be their tendency. And I think also you can see this in some types of OSR game, which have more kind of horror-y monsters. So when you meet a monster that is a special thing, and the kind of like rank and file bad guys are typically people. The more common fantasy version is a world which has some unique monsters. So for example, we might say that there are many orcs, but there is only one Tarrasque. This, to me, represents a view that I think you do get in mythology, where there are types of monster and then there are individual monsters. So to take an example from Greek mythology, there are lots of harpies, but there's only one Minotaur. In this type of game, we're going to be contrasting the individuality of the unique monster with the more generic monster type. Finally, we have games in which monsters are narratively unique or close to it. So an example of this would be something like Vaesen, where, you know, you might run into a troll or something like that. And I don't think there's any attempt to make it be like, oh, this is the troll. You know, you understand that there are trolls in the world, but you're probably not going to run into two trolls. Or if you do, they're going to be very different from each other. You can see this on a show like Grimm, at least initially, right? In the early seasons of Grimm, each monster is described as being representative of a type, which is the conceit that kind of informs the show's monster research. But for the most part, they do only appear once. What many of these stories have in common is that the monster is a unit of narrative. So each of these unique monsters is a story. Now, that is not always the case. So the weird one-off demons in sword and sorcery tales are usually just there to provide atmosphere. It's not necessarily the case that Conan figures out how to fight the monster. That does happen sometimes. There are stories in which Conan kind of solves a monster puzzle, but there are also ones in which Conan just remarks on how strange the creature is while he's fighting it with a sword or running away from it. Within modern D&D, I think that there are comparatively few unique monsters, and insofar as they exist, they tend to be characterized. So they are named individuals, usually intelligent, usually capable of, you know, holding a conversation with you. So Asmodeus, or Vecna, or Strahd von Zarevich. All three of which, I guess, are examples of types. So, you know, Asmodeus is a devil, Strahd is a vampire, Vecna is a lich. Although they may be distinct from the type. So Asmodeus is not just any devil and doesn't have exactly the same powers as any other devil. But more commonly in D&D, what we see is that the game genericizes creatures that are supposed to be individual. So in the mythology that they come from, Chimera, Lamia, Pegasus, Minotaur, etc., etc. These are unique creatures, and they have become types of creature in their translation to fantasy role-playing game. And I think that this also contributes to the way in which those creatures are treated naturalistically. So it's okay to have a mythical origin for a single creature, but it makes less sense-ish to treat each Pegasus as a product of an act of mythic creation. So if we want to take a look at how to use unique monsters effectively, I think we have to turn outside the conventional fantasy RPG, which tends to genericize creatures rather than make them unique. Let's start with a few examples from literature or from TV or whatever. We can begin with Smaug. Do you say Smaug or Smaug? I've always said Smaug, but to be honest, I have no reason to assume that that's correct. But that's what I've always said, so that's what I'm going to stick with. Anyway, Smaug is set up in a number of interesting ways. First, people talk about him from the jump, right? Core characters in The Hobbit have suffered at his hands. He is built up long before he appears. And he exists in a world in which there are a lot of generic monsters. So there are lots of goblins, and there are lots of giant spiders, and there are lots of, I mean, even trolls. Even trolls are a little bit commonplace. But Smaug is individualized. Individualized, but not humanized. He's also intimately tied to a particular location, so he has a lair. These are all good examples of ways in which this monster is made special. So I should also say that he is an example of a monster type, and well, we'll see other examples of this, but I do think that it helps that he is an example of a monster type, even though he himself is a unique individual, because this means that his powers don't have to be explained. Everybody knows what a dragon is and that they like fly and they're big and they breathe fire. In addition to being associated with a particular location, another Tolkien creation, Shelob, adds another gimmick in that she is a monster who terrorizes other monsters. So having established that, you know, hobbits should be afraid of orcs, we then get some orcs being afraid of Shelob. This can feel like throwing a fight in order to help get a monster over, but I do think that it works effectively in the case of Shelob because the protagonists have spent so long being frightened of orcs. Come to think of it, this is also true of Dracula. You know, we see Dracula in monster mode quite early on, frightening off the brides. And so we understand him as a figure who's commanding and intimidating, even to people that the narrator and thus the readers are quite frightened of. Dracula, unlike Smaug or Shelob, well, certainly unlike Smaug, is revealed to the audience and the characters through a process of discovery. And I do think that at the time Dracula came out, the vampire was not as much of a widely understood media monster. Like, everybody didn't know, oh yeah, vampires are like this, and they can do that, and they can't go here, and they're vulnerable to this. Whereas Smaug and Shelob cut the explanation time required by being instances of more broadly well-understood monster types. Another example of the monster that has to be discovered over the course of a narrative would be a creature like the Predator. Now, obviously, that is no longer a unique monster, but within its original film context, it is not an example of another monster type other than the broad category of alien. It does draw on some kind of most dangerous game trope, so it's not completely dissociated from anything that audience members understand, but it does need to have its rules explained, and that's done over the course of this process of discovery by the main characters, right? That the bit by bit they identify what are its abilities, what are its limitations, etc., etc. Obviously, the later films reduce the Predator's uniqueness, as I said, going so far as to have multiple Predators in a couple of the movies, but I think that the good ones, so that's Predator 2 and Prey, for those of you playing along at home, pay off the process of discovery in interesting ways. So Prey, for instance, uses the fact that we, as audience members, know the rules of Predator to give us this kind of seat watching the process of learning about the creature and its weaknesses in a way that illuminates the character of the protagonist rather than tells us more about the creature, because we already know that stuff. I mentioned individualizing a creature through a lair. Obviously, a lot of unique monsters are boss monsters and therefore can be characterized through their lair. You know, it's definitely part of the appeal of some unique monsters. A cool lair obviously can be a great setting for the villain, but it can also be used to reveal clues about the villain's powers and weaknesses. It can be used to illuminate their character or aesthetic, a lot like Castle Dracula in many of its incarnations, but the one that popped into my mind was Castlevania. Now, these are just assuming that monsters are unique narratively, or unique in the sense that they are individualized characters. But what about the type of unique monster that was referenced in Luke's original question to me, where he talked about the idea of this monster being the last of its kind? This is a very resonant image. It can symbolize the end of an age of magic. It can symbolize the destruction of an ecosystem. You know, we love this kind of story, from the last unicorn to the last dragon. Actually, you know, now that I think about it, The Last Dragon is not about a dragon. It's actually about Kung Fu. But there are lots of movies with last dragons in them. You know, most infamously, is it Dragonheart with Sean Connery? The one where Sean Connery plays the last one? Now, in general, I think that if you're going to do a last dragon or last, you know, type of monster creature, you are better off doing this with monsters that people already know, or at least can kind of easily pick up what it is they're supposed to do. The last giant, the last of the rainbow serpents, the last what have you. I think it's tricky to introduce a whole monster type and then explain what it is, and then tell the players that there's only one left. Now, you can get away with this as long as you establish beforehand what the monster was like. And I feel like this kind of thing works better in lower fantasy games, but it doesn't have to be. So, you know, the evil wizard summoned an army of demons. Each of them had the strength of 10 mortals. They had the sting of a scorpion and flaming breath. Phew! Good thing there's none of them still around, am I right? You know, I think if you do this, the players will obviously be thinking that the creatures will turn up, but they'll also be enjoying the anticipation. That isn't the only way to approach setting up a monster and then declaring something to be the last one of it. So, for instance, you could set up the monsters as lost and then introduce them as some kind of odd standout. Yeah. You know who could tell us where the blue jewel is? One of the stone bisons. Well, sure, but they all died out years ago. Well, funny you should mention that. There have been some rumors. So here the last off status becomes a way to create a scarcity effect. So we can't just go ask any old stone bison because they're very rare and we have to probably go on some quest to the stone prairie to find one and so on and so forth. Here, the being last of its kind is what makes it special. So these are some different approaches to unique monsters. And I think the way to make unique monsters within the context of a particular campaign special is to mix these different approaches. Because I feel like there's a risk that if you continually have basically the same kind of unique monster, let's, for example, take the sort of weird little guy, right? This is a monster type that turns up a good amount in my games. I think it's pretty common these days under the influence of games like Elden Ring or whatever. They're full of weird little guys. But let's say you decide to have a lot of weird little guys in your game. After a while, their specialness will wear off as players just go, yeah, okay, it's another weird little guy. So if you have unique monsters, you know, no two of these little guys are weird in the same way, but they're all kind of roughly similar, they will get lumped into a single category. So we need to use multiple techniques from this list. So maybe like one unique monster is individualized through its lair, and a different unique monster is more of a kind of procedural mystery that the players have to solve, figure out what are its strengths and weaknesses. And then the next one is a monster where what's important about it is that it is the last, and the sense of loneliness is going to wind up being important to what we want the players to get out of that experience. And then the next one is just, you know, an ape with bat wings reskin of an existing monster to remind the players that the world is full of strange creatures. This is very characteristically what I do in my game. So a lot of the time the PCs will be fighting creatures that are just kind of, you know, they're mephits or they're goblins or whatever, and I have just kind of aesthetically described them as something weird. And because those fights are far enough apart, I don't think that they ever really think, oh, these monsters are mechanically a bit similar to each other, because they're spread out. And I'm often inspired by the look and feel of a monster that's kind of based on a miniature or something that I own. So for instance, there's a miniature from Ramshackle Games sculpted by a guy who makes miniatures videos on YouTube under the name Five Header, numeral 5. And the creature is horrible looking and it's called the Toe Tickler. which people don't like. I don't like it. So one of my players were facing down a cult of baddies who summon extra dimensional monsters to fight for them. I did the CR scale and whatever, and I figured out that a good opponent for the group would be a Bodok. But instead of using the Bodok stats provided, I just put the Toad Tickler miniature down on the table, and I had the villain go, "Toe Tickler, defend me," or whatever, and the players all went, "Toe Tickler?" And since I own a lot of models of weird, gross monsters, this works out nicely. I don't know how weird the players think that is, but I do think that it reinforces the overall idea of the world. Specifically, this part of the world is full of strange spirits, many of them weird, even to the spirit expert druid in the party. And one of the ways that I do that is by using miniatures that look bizarre. You know, whereas, given what the monsters are mechanically, they could be fighting something that looks a little more like a conventional fantasy monster, but I want it to be strange grotesques, which I guess are just another form of weird little guy. And it works because I don't think that any individual weird creature is detailed all that much or made the center of attention. And consequently, it reinforces the overall idea that this part of the world is full of weird creatures. So if you happen to meet, you know, a little slime man or a talking bunny rabbit or whatever, those are all pretty normal and you should react accordingly. Hello, it's James from the future here. So, to take a quick trip behind the scenes of the production of this podcast, during the recording of this episode, the program that I used to record it crashed, and I sorted out the problem, and I recorded a second half of the episode and kind of stitched them together, but in that process, part of the episode was lost. I'm now going to try to kind of complete those thoughts, and it doesn't like flow very naturally from the previous bit, which is why I wanted to tell you why that was. I was talking about the idea of making monsters aesthetically, if not mechanically, unique. Although, you know, having said that, in a way they are mechanically unique because, again, I'm not constrained by any of the in-universe things that tend to put similar monsters together. So if this thing is mechanically a star spawn and that thing's a hobgoblin and this other thing's a mephit, I leave aside monsters that tend to have very clear themes, your elementals and such. But otherwise, I just kind of put whatever odd gloss I want on things. So I made it sound as if they were just very mechanically bland monsters with weird skins on them. But sometimes they're mechanically weird monsters with weird skins on them, and they're often eclectic mixtures of different monsters with weird skins on them. And I kind of try to follow the inspiration of just whatever the miniature looks like it probably does. Now, having said that, I realize that that is a strategy that is kind of unique to someone like me, where I sort of have this thing where I have a very eclectic miniatures collection. And one of the things that I love to collect and paint is weird little monsters, including things inspired by medieval marginalia or by folk horror or whatever. So I am unusually well suited to do this, right? Like if you have a big miniatures collection, it's just like, oh, I play Warhammer and I have a lot of orcs. Well, that isn't going to be as useful. And many people, indeed most people, don't really use miniatures very much when they play RPGs in the first place. They might use counters, or they might not have any sort of, you know, do it all, as they say, theater off the mind. But I believe that you can still make this work. The thing is that you can't include a lot of description of the monster, because if you're doing the thing where you have a lot of eclectic monsters that is intended to just create the sense that this area is weird. So in my campaign, if you were to go outside this region, the Hexenmark, you would find that most of the monsters are what you would expect to be there. So if you go to kind of the vampire-y region to the north, there would be lots of like wolves howling in the woods and ghouls pawing at the graveyards. It's here that things are kind of thematically out of whack. But because these are monsters that just represent like the hazard of travel or whatever, right? These aren't plot monsters. They've just infested this dungeon because they infest things. That's what they do. I don't want to spend a lot of time describing them to the players as though they were a puzzle. And a visual thing, like a miniature or an illustration, is a very simple way to do that, because I don't need to tell people or take up time or mental space outlining what this monster looks like when it's completely unimportant, because I just actually have a thing that I can show them and that's what it looks like. But you can do that without any visual element. I mean, you can absolutely have a visual element where you just like Google weird monster or, you know, medieval marginalia illustration or whatever. And, you know, I'm sure a Google image search will turn up a bunch of stuff. But also, I think if you just do one element of description for each creature, it works out just fine. So if you just say it advances towards you cackling and clicking its shears, or, you know, instead of like it swipes a claw at you, you just say one of the mouths that it has instead of eyes opens and a long tongue shoots out, or the face that it has in its stomach breathes fire at you. All of those things are still just like, yeah, roll to hit, roll damage, but they provide that kind of weird and chaotic look and feel that I'm trying to achieve with these types of creatures. So although I do this visually, I don't think you have to do it visually. I just think visually is a very easy way to do it. And by easy, I mean difficult and time consuming, because obviously I spend a lot of time painting these miniatures and they cost money. It's just that I already spent that money and I already painted these models. So to me, mentally, it's not expensive because I've already discounted the time and money that I've already spent, if you see what I mean. And that can be hard because a unique monster, you know, people are used to looking at an orc and thinking, oh, an orc. People are used to looking at even like a dragon and thinking, oh, a dragon, right? It's not that they think it's unimportant, but they understand where it fits. And their first thing when they deal with a unique monster is going to be trying to figure out where it fits. And if the monster is a mystery, if the monster is meant to be puzzled out, then you can spend a lot of time describing its appearance and its behavior. But if it's just a hazard, or if it's just, you know, an obstacle that the players have to get past in order to get to the thing that's actually interesting, then you don't want to spend too much time laying out what might seem to be clues, but are in fact merely detail. And this is one of the dangers that can come when you try to translate something from one medium into another. We see this a lot with attempts to translate like the work of particular artists into games. You spend a lot of time describing this Geiger-esque thing, but the message of it is just like, wow, that's kind of messed up looking, huh? So I don't think that a visual approach is necessary for dealing with these kinds of creatures. I think you can do it with description for sure, but I also think it's important to keep a light touch. All right, I now return you to your regularly scheduled podcast. And I think that this kind of smaller aesthetic change can really go a long way. Okay, so those are some different techniques for making effective use of unique monsters in your campaign. If you've got some other advice about how to deploy these kinds of creatures, why not leave a comment? I try to keep up with comments on the Patreon site. It's not perfect, but I think I'm getting most of them. Coming up here on the feed, we've got an all-new episode of Patron Deities, and this one is going to be about this guy, either the last or next to last fictional deity before we get into our season on Haitian voodoo. But we're going to take a look at the Emperor of Mankind, the deity, who protects, humanity from the Warhammer 40,000 setting. Later on this week, we're going to have an all-new special episode. Remember, we are currently in Oops All Specials, and we're going to take a look at Devastation Beetles. So I hope that you will join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you've got a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, why not get in touch? I'm on Twitter as @GonzoHistory, on Mastodon as GonzoHistory@dice.camp, or you can find me on Instagram at MonsterManGonzo, or drop me an email, GonzoHistory@gmail.com. Our theme music is an extract from Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, and is used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Our cover art is by Ray Otis. Thanks for listening, and please join me next time for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great.